Hello and welcome to 81 All Out. This is your host, Siddhartha Vaidyanathan, and I would like to thank you for taking the time out to listen to this podcast. We are a crowdfunded endeavor, and you can support us at ko-fi.com. That's ko-fi.com/81allout to keep the show going.
In the air, Srishant takes it! India wins!
He'll come back for the second. India have won the test match. India have won the series.
They're going to get back for two. India are home. Lords goes wild.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the 81 All Out podcast. Today we have a very special episode, and I'm thrilled to introduce the guest today, my friend, and as I was telling him just before the recording, the Don Corleone of the internet, Prem Panikkar. Hello, Prem. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Sid. I'll try and do my best, Marlon Brando, but no, seriously, I mean, you introduced me as a friend, and I'm grateful. I've been an admirer of your work from your Cricket and Four days. And 81 All Out is one of those podcasts that, still a cricket fan, occasionally lapsing, but it's the one I follow. So,
Okay, wonderful. That. And talking about, the following your work, I must tell listeners that, back in the late 90s, I was still in high school at that time, and, we had a very dodgy internet connection. So every time I used to go to rediff.com and try and read the cricket reports, my internet invariably used to hang. This is not an indictment on Rediff, by the way. This is an indictment on my modem connection, which used to the dial-up modem. And so I used to tell my dad, whenever he used to go to work, because he had a good connection there, I used to tell him to go and print out all these reports that Prem used to write. So he used to get it all in the evening. And I remember, sitting when the moment my dad came back, it was almost like, the goodies had come home, and I used to give me the reports, and I used to sit for the next 1 hour and happily, lap up everything. So, Prem, thank you for that, for the post-school entertainment and enrichness that you gave me.
Yeah, I suppose part of the reason why it was lagging was because the bloody reports are so long. Yeah.
But those days, that was a thrill for me because, I used to read the newspaper reports and magazine reports that all had word limits. And then this was a whole new world that opened up to me to see like 3,000, 4,000 words of writing on a cricket match day. It was brilliant. But Prem, let's begin. So this chat, I would love to chat with Prem about cricket and technology. That's how broad I've kept this topic. But I feel Prem is a great person to talk about this because he's had a ringside view through and through. Growing up, I guess he would have consumed a lot of the game through the radio and through print. And then, of course, he would have seen the television boom and the television era. And he was at the forefront of the internet era. And then ever since then, even over the last 15 years, he's been, dabbled with so much of, he's of course on social media big time, but he's also dabbled in a lot of other technology and he's understood technology considerably well. So Prem, take us a bit back to, slightly younger days and introduction to cricket. Was radio a big deal back then or was print bigger?
It was a mix of pretty much everything, Sid. Radio was big, yes. Print, I remember back then when there was a test match in the offing, you would have about 3 to 4 pages dedicated to cricket alone. And this was not just the Hindu, which gave a lot of space to cricket, even in Indian Express. You would have things like before the start of a series, for instance, you would have 3 pages of player profiles, 2 of those pages obviously being about the Indian players, and then 1 page would be whoever we were playing against. Radio, obviously. Ironically, I actually saw a test match live before I followed a test match on radio. I think I was about 11 at the time, 1969. This was December. Australia was playing India at Chennai. So you had a lot of the great players, Chappell, Laurie, Walters, there was Paul Sheehan, Ian Redpath.
Yeah.
Garth McKenzie played in that series. Ashley Mallett, whose return catches used to be incredible. And India had, Gavaskar hadn't entered the arena yet. So it was Chauhan and Mankad. You had Wadekar, Vishwanath, Engineer, Patawdy, who was dropped earlier in that series and then brought back. You had Solker. You had Amarnath batting somewhere as far below. He was at that time seen as a bowler who could bat a little bit, an opening bowler, which was the standard of a pace attack at that time, if you like. He was batting.
And that was also Vishwanath's debut, right? Debut series.
Correct, yes. Amarnath was batting at about 8 or 9, if I remember, and Venkat played. So for the Chennai boys, it was a big thing. What used to happen back then was, talking of technology, there was this thing where you could go to any phone, even a phone booth, and just dial a toll-free number, and a voice would read out the latest score for you. How this worked was that next to the commentator's booth, there was this room where there were a dozen operators manning two dozen phones, which would keep ringing, and the operator picked up the phone and read off from the scoreboard. Mom at that time was a mid-level official in the telephones department, and she was given the supervisory duty. So it was quite cool. Best seat in the house. All you had to do was watch the cricket. There's nothing to supervise, really, right? Unless the line goes down and she has to call GSQ and get it fixed or something. Yeah. So she managed to smuggle me into the stadium, and that's how I sat and watched that entire series. Of course, there were a lot of caveats. I had to do well in my half-yearly and all of that, but yeah, I managed. And then there was the 1971 tour of the West Indies, which introduced me to radio, which was kind of, again, when you look back on it, you realize that following a game on radio made it somehow far more precious. We had this old radio called UMS. The brand was UMS. Valve radios, they called them at the time. They would have a wire sticking out of the back, and you somehow went to the top of the tree and tied it up there, hoping that the reception would be better. It never was. And my uncle, my father's younger brother, who was staying with us at that time, he accidentally figured out that if you took another wire from the same place where the aerial was connected to the radio and you held it between your fingers, the reception improved. I don't know what the science behind that is, but so I got the duty of holding on to this damn thing all day, which can cramp your fingers. So I learned to tie it around my finger. And what used to happen was that Dad and my uncle and mom would go to work, except for Saturday, Sunday when they were at home. And I had to maintain a scoreboard because they didn't want to wait for the next day. So I'd sit in front of the radio throughout the course of the match and meticulously score the match. So you had to mark the fours and the sixes, and all of them at home were cricket fans. So it wasn't enough for the scoreboard. They would ask how was the shot played, and I would demonstrate Gavaskar straight drive as if I'd seen it. So I had this little bat at that time, and I don't know if they were indulging me or whatever, but they would ask, so how did he hit that four? And I would say, oh, you know, he came down the wicket and his bat was dead straight. You're listening to the radio, right? So Anand Setalwad and Berry Sarbadikari, people like that. And I think in an odd kind of way, that is when I learned to make notes when watching a match, because I knew that they would want granular detail. So every now and again, I would scribble down something or the other about how, say, for instance, somebody had bowled to Gavaskar and how Gavaskar had played, and about the Sardesai Solker stance. They would, if you remember, Solker would play these very gritty back of the order innings. So yeah, that was brilliant, because you absorbed cricket in such a granular way that you don't know. Even when you're watching cricket, there are 10 other things happening, WhatsApp messages coming in, or, you know, something going on Twitter or whatever. Here it was nothing. It is just the voice in your head telling you what is going on. And
struck me when you started off talking about your growing up was the, you spoke about the team, you said 69 Australia, and then you listed the names, you know, you said Gavaskar, Munkard, before Gavaskar. You listed the team. And I've noticed that people of my age and people of an older age, it's a very common thing among us who to say, you know, I mean, if you talk about the great West Indies team, you just automatically start the lineup, Haynes, Greenidge, yeah, you know, exactly. Richards. Yeah. But I wonder if, I don't know if that kind of a memory and rhythm and conversation happens now, and whether lineups stick so vividly as they used to before.
Yeah, I mean, the second match that I watched live in the stands, by then I had graduated to the school stands because those days schools had these quotas. You could get tickets. And yeah. I didn't want to sit with mom in that box when I could be with my peers yelling and screaming and all of that. And I remember the entire lineup. It was Fredericks, Greenidge, Kalacharan, Richards, Lloyd. There was Derek Murray, Bernard Julian, Van Burn Holder, Andy Roberts, Lance Gibbs.
Oh, wow.
And in India was, this is the Pongal test, right? I mean, yeah. Famous in Chennai. India had engineer Solker, Gaikwad, Pataudi, who had by then been reinstated as captain. There was Munkard, Madanlal, Gavri, and the three spinners, of course, Chandra, Bedi, and Prasanna. So, and I remember Roberts taking 7-4 in the first innings and 5-4 in the second. All of this I remember distinctly. But if you ask me, the lineup and the top performers of the previous test that we just played, I have to look at the scoreboard. So yeah, right. I suppose it's a measure of how much we treasured these moments at that time and how fleeting our involvement with the game is. We were completely involved when it's happening, but a moment later, 10 other things happen that submerges our memories, I guess.
Yeah, I wonder if 20 years or 30 years down the line, if you know, kids today will remember, say, the GABA test with as granular a detail. I would hope they would, but you know, time will only tell me. I mean, maybe I could ask people who grew up in the 2000s, you know, to about that. But coming to you know, gradually moving on from that to television, I guess television would have been a huge leap for India of that time and for generally to suddenly see all these players come to life on your screen.
Yeah, true. I remember we got television for the first time because the 82 Football World Cup was going to be televised. It's funny, I mean, back home in Calicut, my other uncles and all that are huge football fans. Mm-hmm. Dad wasn't particularly, but somehow this whole thing of television, it's coming in color, all of that. So we got this color TV, and that is when we started watching. And then, of course, there was 83 and everything else that happened. And yeah, it was a different experience. I mean, you processed it initially through your ears, right? I mean, you heard the commentators talk about how it was played, and it created images in your head. And then suddenly to actually see that, I suppose it had its good side and bad side, because the good side was you got to see. You didn't need the commentary anymore. The bad side was you realized that a lot of the commentary that you heard was probably completely off point, because the guy would talk about a drive and all that. And what you were seeing was a sort of airy-fairy edge going through wherever it was. There was a disconnect. But yeah, watching players for the first time, that was amazing. And I think that is where you started understanding the game a bit more. I mean, for all the description that you can get, you kind of made it up, right? I mean, you were learning cricket at that time, and so when somebody says cover drive, okay, you have a vague picture, but you don't realize the nuances. There's a huge difference between, say, Mohammad Azharuddin playing a cover drive and Sachin Tendulkar playing a cover drive and VVS Lakshman playing a cover drive, Dilip Vengsarkar. Through the years, a cover drive is a cover drive. Once you see it, it becomes, you start seeing the nuances. I was thinking of what you used to do first in Cricket Info and then on your own blog and all that, where you would take one stroke or one moment and write about it.
Yeah.
I don't suppose that was possible. It wouldn't have been possible back in the day when all you had to rely on was the radio, because
yeah, I mean that really, then you would have had to be a large fictional component there as well. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah,
yeah.
So I have no idea of all those cover drives that I demonstrated for my parents and uncle. Anything to do with reality, but hell, that's what it was, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I guess someone like Neville Cardis, who you know is the doyen of cricket writing. It also helped that he wrote about cricket at a time when hardly anyone saw it. So because a lot of his, larger than life characterizations and his embellishments, he could get away with partly because of that. I mean, in this day and age, I'm sure there would be people on Twitter pointing out the 15 errors that he's made in his writing.
Absolutely. And even before social media came along, if you remember, we used to have, Cricket Info also used to do this in your time where, people could comment, and the comments would be, "What the hell are you talking about? That's not what happened." You know, sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, when we used to do ball by ball commentary, and I'm sure you too have noticed this. I mean, you just make like one minor mistake, and within 10 seconds, people tell you about it.
Yeah, and they tell you in no uncertain terms. It's like, you know, what the hell are you doing here? One of the most common comments I used to get is, who the hell are you to write about all this? You know, why don't you stick to politics or whatever? So,
and now people are telling you to stick to cricket.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if I say something about politics, it's like, just go back to cricket. You don't know anything about what you're talking about. So yeah, this whole thing of instantaneous feedback and all of that came later. I think it was a quieter time. You could sort of marinate in the cricket without all this noise, and it helped that I wasn't doing cricket at the time, right? So I was just a fan, and there's a huge difference between watching as a fan and watching because you have to, or because you have to write a report or whatever.
And what struck me when you said about watching the first experience of television being the 1982 Football World Cup. I mean, that you got the peakest of the peakest of the most beautiful team to watch as your first television experience with the Brazilian team.
Yeah, I remember when I was in Yahoo much later, just before the World Cup, this was 2012, something like that, I'd started writing about this whole thing, the way television came to India and watching Socrates and his team, play to the samba rhythms and stuff. It was mesmeric. There's this book about 10 games that Brazil lost, mm-hmm. and not being able to figure out why yet. And one of those games, one of those reports starts with this incident where Falcao, who was then a journalist, He was covering the lead up to a World Cup, and he goes to, I think it was Portugal, where there was some kind of practice match being played, and he was pissed off because he had just been flying all over the place covering these no account matches. And at the immigration counter, the man looks at the passport, looks at Falcao, looks at the passport, then looks back at Falcao, and then he says, "How in the hell did you lose that match?" And so I use that as a lead in to how this thing has haunted Brazil all its life, the 82 team losing the World Cup.
We had Mudar Pateria on the podcast a few months earlier, and he mentioned how until 78 and 82, football was so huge in Calcutta that you thought that the players that you were watching were world class, and then you saw all this on television, and then you realized, okay, what I'm watching is actually like 10 notches below what these guys are playing.
Yeah, there's a funny thing about that, though. The Sao Paulo Juniors came on a trip to India. This was sometime in the, I think, late 80s.
Okay.
India, the first, they were playing 5 exhibition matches. And in the first match, it was, I think it was in Goa or someplace. And so you had a lot of the Goan players and a couple of the internationals playing. And these kids just ran circles around them. So it started going around the country, and finally it was in Eden Gardens. By then, India had lost all the 4 games by substantial margins. So at the Eden Gardens, they had the full Indian team, and these kids apparently ran circles around them. I think we lost by about 4 goals or whatever, and these guys could have made it, I don't know, 14 if they wanted to. They were just playing with the Indians. And I understand where Mudar is coming from, because I used to follow these games so intensely. Ooh, Habib, Akbar, you know, all of those names. Mm. It also helped that one of my uncles was K.S. Sedumadhavan, who was the Indian goalkeeper at that time.
Yeah.
So yeah, you got to go watch matches in Calicut and elsewhere when teams were playing, and it is quite stunning the difference between standards. It's also like kind of watching. I mean, I mentioned the 75 West Indies team, but before that there was the 73 England team.
Tony Lewis, right?
Yeah, Tony Lewis, Dennis Amos, there was Alan Knott, there was Mike Dennis, Keith Fletcher was there, Tony Greig was there. That was the Chennai test was the one where Tony Greig got so pissed off with Solker, who was standing so close to him, that at one point he playfully raised his bat to hit him and get him out of forward short leg. And Solker, when he said forward short leg, it was actually forward short leg. The guy was standing right on, almost at the edge of the pitch. So, yeah, it's a different era. It meant so much.
So, given how you know, fond you were of cricket and how closely you were watching it, it doesn't seem that at any point of time you actually wanted to get into writing about it, because obviously you started your career as a journalist, and with nothing to do with cricket, you covered politics and so many other beats. Was it simply because it didn't seem like a viable career then, or was cricket just too, you know, seemed a bit too light for someone like you, who was interested in the far more serious, and who is still interested in the far more serious?
I got into journalism because I loved telling stories. I loved the idea of going places and seeing what was actually there, as opposed to, you know, what I was absorbing. I think the reason I didn't do cricket was probably I never thought of it in the first place, and then there was a lot of happenstance to it, because I started with Free Press, which by about 6 months into that, I was offered a job with the Indian Post when Nikhil Lakshman took over that paper from Vinod Mehta. And there you had the Krasto brothers, Daryl, Ivan, the entire Krasto cousins and brothers, yeah, and all of that doing it. So there was no room. Indian Post at that time had about, when Nikhil took over, Vinod Mehta had taken the entire staff away with him. The only staff that remained intact was the sports desk, which was headed by Shyam, S.K. Shyam. Mm-hmm. And you had all these Krastos and all that. So the need never arose. And obviously, because the beat was covered, I didn't even think about it. From there, I moved to Midday, where Hemal Asher and Sharda Ugra were heading the sports desk. Yeah. And both of them are brilliant, and both of them are very intolerant of you know, some amateur wanting to sort of get into their space. So Sharda would kind of shoo you away if you went anywhere near her desk. So it just was... thing. After that, I went to Sunday Observer, where I was doing the features magazine, the magazine section. So again, cricket didn't come up. I would be editing and putting together the magazine and writing features for it, and also writing features or investigative reports for the main paper. But I never did cricket. I think it was just You know how it is when you're a professional journalist, you do what is required of you. It was never required. And while I was watching cricket during that period, it again, even in Sunday Observer, the Krastev brothers were there. So they pretty much did all that needed to be done, and there was nothing for me to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. So talking about things that are new and things that are fresh, I found out recently that February 1996 was the first time you wrote on cricket for Rediff. But tell us a bit about you and Rediff and you getting in there, and also the landscape at that time with respect to the internet, especially in India. What did really people think of it at the time? And was there, you know, this whole, like any new technology, were there people saying, this is just a fad, nothing's going to come of it, this is the big distraction of our times?
I don't think people saw it as a distraction so much, Sid. I think people saw it as, what the hell is this all about? Frankly, I think the first conversation about my joining Rediff. So Ajit Balakrishnan had spoken to Nikhil Lakshman, who was then my editor. I mean, he's the only editor I worked with. So at that time, we were both in the Sunday Observer. And Ajit had several conversations with Nikhil about this new technology that was emerging. I think the conversation started around August 95, when the internet was opened up for commercial exploitation. I think about a month later, Nikhil called me. By then, he had left Sunday Observer. And I was kind of holding the fort. And Nikhil called me and said, there's a gentleman who wants to speak to you. So I went, and that's when I met Ajit. And he told me about this technology. Nikhil was there, Ajit was there. They told me about this technology and what their plans were. It said, would you want to join? Around the same time, Vivek Goenka was asking me if I would join the Indian Express as resident editor. For me, I think the choice was dictated by the fact that, you know how it is with the newspaper world. One of the things that happens is there is a template, right? I mean, there is a front page, and then there are city pages, and then there is national page, and there is this and that. And beyond a point in time, it is more a matter of filling in the blanks. There's nothing unknown. Things happen every day and you have to figure out how to cover it. But once you've done that for a bit, it becomes a matter of routine. There is no fresh challenge, nothing, no problem that you're trying to solve. You just go in, you do your thing, you come back, you do your thing all over again, that sort of thing. So of the two choices, Rediff, though it is less well paid at the time than the other option that I had, Rediff was attractive because this was new. I hadn't seen the internet before. I had no idea what it was. And when Ajit tried to demonstrate it, this was not during that first conversation. This was after I said yes. The modem connection was so bloody slow that I was wondering, what the heck this whole thing was.
It was that cricket.
Yeah, that twang kind of sound would come in and nothing was happening. And I was like, okay, what are we supposed to do with this thing? In fact, I remember in the lead up to our launch and stuff like that, those early MS-DOS systems and stuff, I just couldn't wrap my head around the damn thing. So I'd be writing something and suddenly it would all vanish. And the only person who knew everything was Ajit, right? So I didn't realize that he was the publisher and the owner and the joint head of Rediffusion and advertising and such a big shot and all that. I was like, Ajit, can you help me? I lost track of this. And poor fellow, he would have to come in and say, Prem, this is what you're supposed to do. What are you doing? And it was kind of, in fact, the original template for Rediff was actually on pen and paper.
Oh, wow.
It was not on the internet. Yeah, I mean, none of us knew the internet. None of us knew what to do. None of us knew what tech was. Just coding A equals HREF, I mean, AHREF, whatever, all of that. And realizing that if you got one little thing wrong, and these were best early computers, right? Very easy to make mistakes and very hard to spot them because there was no spell check and there was no all of the modern tools. And you would do all that work, and when you tried to publish, nothing would come of it. And then you had to go through every single character that you had typed in to see where the bloody mistake came from. So it was kind of, in a sense, yeah, a complete leap of faith. And your point about how people viewed it, I think the classic way of describing it is when we were trying to recruit for Rediff in the early days before the actual launch, nobody would join.
Yeah, because none they didn't know what the hell was going on.
and they were like, look, we have bylines, we are working for Indian Express and Hindu and Times of India and all of that. And what is this damn thing being done in a garage in a corner of, you know, Nariman Point? Actually, it was Fort Area. Tiny little street, fairly dilapidated building in which we had a small office. Basically, it was just one room where everybody sat. And in the early days, we actually had this thing where there weren't enough computers to go around. So, so you kind of took turns and all of that.
Definitely not pandemic friendly.
Definitely not pandemic friendly. Definitely not work friendly. And because we had to learn this thing while actually working on it, we had gotten into the habit of actually sleeping on the floor. 2-3 days we would be in the office. And then go home one day because we didn't even have a shower in the office. So when you started smelling so much that your colleagues kept pushing. So then you went to the went home, had a shower, slept for a bit and came right back. In fact, I remember one late night discussion, very animated discussion about whether Business Standard or The Hindu was a better paper to sleep on. And
wow.
Yeah, somebody was making the argument that The Hindu, because it was thicker ply, so it gave you more insulation, and it is madness, complete madness.
Yeah, so but as when you were growing up, though, I'm always intrigued by the people who, like you, who took this leap of faith, you know, in the mid-90s into this new era. Were you somebody who was always, you know, who would open up the transistor to figure out how it was working? Were you tech? Did you veer towards tech?
Yeah, I mean, opening up the transistor, I remember, I told you about that UMS radio, and there was a time when it kind of conked out. And you know how it is back in the day, right? For any purchase, you have endless rounds of discussion. It's like the corporate world today. You had to have presentations and budgeting and all of that. So
ROI.
Yeah. So the replacement radio wasn't coming. And this uncle of mine and I sat down one day, and it was a weekend. And we took the back of the radio and pulled everything out. And, you know, we found that some of the wires had frayed and all that. So we got hold of new wires and we connected everything up. The thing is, even in those days, a wire would be cut precisely and soldered into place, right? We didn't have soldering irons and stuff. So we kind of attached it any which way we knew how. And for a 3-inch wire, we would have used a 1-foot long wire. And finally, the whole damn thing wouldn't go back into the box. So our radio, for a while, until we got a new one, was actually this case of the UMS and a whole lot of innards that had spilled out because we couldn't fit it back. And so yeah, in a sense, I love fiddling around with things. I don't think there was, until Rediff happened, until 1995, I opened this thing up, I wasn't that aware of tech. We had used some cutting-edge technology in the Indian Post. There was a production system called ATEX, which was brilliant for that time, and I think it's still brilliant for today. Mm-hmm. Made the whole process of editorial from writing a story to editing it to actually putting it on the page. You could do all that from your terminal. And that was the highest tech we had. We introduced, or at least Tariq Ansari introduced computers in midday about halfway through my stint over there. So yeah, I think my initial attitude towards tech was anything that made the mechanical chores of an editorial office easier, I was all for. Otherwise, if you remember, we had to print out your stories on galleys and then cut them, and editing on a galley with a paper knife.
Oh, yeah.
Taking out one word and then trying to, yeah, all of that. This made it so simple, right? I mean, you took out a word and everything readjusted automatically. So yeah, I loved tech for that reason.
Absolutely. And so forwarding on February 96, how did cricket happen?
Hey, I told you, nobody was joining. Harsha was a friend. He had written for us in midday. So we asked Harsha. He said, I can write the occasional column, but I can't do match reports because I've been commissioned by somebody or the other to do that. And none of the cricket writers would join Rediff. So there was about a week to go for the World Cup, and there were about, I think at that time, 7 journalists. Some of them were specializing in various subjects. There was Yazid Darasha, who was looking after the economic coverage, and there were a couple of people for the politics part of it. And we had a guy called Zaki Ansari, who was very, very tech savvy. I mean, he's the one who really went into the nuts and bolts of how things worked, and he became a go-to resource for anything tech. I suppose I was the only one without a clear brief. So they looked around and said, ah, okay, you played some cricket when you were a kid, so you do cricket. And next thing I know, I'm supposed to be covering a World Cup, doing match reports, and I had no idea what the hell a match report was and how to do it. And back in the day, the rule was that unwritten rule, because of what you spoke about, right? The download times and all that.
Yeah.
I was told that the match report had to fit within one frame. That is all that would download quickly. And I remember the first match I'm watching, I'm making notes. At the end of it, I'm trying to figure out how to write this report. And I realized I couldn't do it in one frame. So I said, the hell with the rules, and I'm going to write this match report the way I think I want to write it. And I just wrote. And it went off into several scrolls. And I published it. Mercifully, the editor didn't see it before, and Ajit Balakrishnan didn't see it. I think they saw it after it was published, and Ajit nearly had a hissy fit. He said, I thought I told you one scroll and all of that. But what happened within a couple of match reports was that we started getting feedback from the US, from people who were reading it and saying, this works for us. It's like actually being there and watching the game. So then I was pretty much left to my own devices. And yeah, that's kind of how cricket reporting started. And then it kind of evolved into ball by ball. Again, it was a matter of, I think, listening to feedback. It was kind of funny in a sense because initially it used to be one match report. And then after a bit, it was about a quarter of the way into the World Cup or one third of the way into the World Cup. I think one of the letters that we got said, look, we are living in a different time zone and we have to wait till we wake up to see what actually happened. So is it possible to do a halftime report after the first innings?
Okay. So
Ajit read that mail and came to me and said, okay, this is one feedback that we got, and what do you think? And I was like, yeah, okay, lunchtime, I can write a report, not a problem. So it started with a halfway report. And then after a bit, there was this thing of, you know, every hour, this is the internet, it's about constant refreshing. Remember, US knew the internet much better than we did. So we were very, very aware of what was coming from there in terms of feedback. I think Ajit had new people in the Indian associations in places like MIT and Harvard and stuff, and he would stay in touch with them. So they would constantly send feedback. So I said, why is there not a paragraph or so every hour? And so again, there was this discussion.
Eventually, what you were doing back in 1996 was basically Twitter, as it was in 2008 or 6.
Pretty much. And the fun part was, I remember there was this one tech person that we had called Srikant. So we were all sitting in the same room. And then Ajit came and told me about this one-hour thing. Out of exasperation, I think I just said, at this rate, these guys are going to be asking for one every other minute. And Srikanth was completely absorbed in whatever he was doing. He just heard this out of the corner of his ear and said, turned around and said, hey, I can make a box for you and you can type whatever you want into it and hit submit and it'll go. So we were like, okay, you make the box. And the guy worked overnight and next day we had this box. So it was like, okay, let's try it. And we announced that there was going to be live commentary. And we ran into so many problems we hadn't anticipated. For one thing, the connections being as slow as they were then, you typed something about a particular ball. At that time, I was doing one or two deliveries together at a time. Very vestigial kind of ball-by-ball commentary. So you type something in and you hit publish. And this thing would, this little round thing would just go round and round on your computer. And those browsers didn't have multiple windows. You had to open a fresh iteration of the browser. So you opened a fresh one and typed the next thing in. And the first one would still be going round and round. And through some quirk, the second one would go off into the web. And the first one wouldn't have gone. So it became a jumble. And yeah, it was until things kind of settled down and you had reliable connections and stuff. It was insane. I remember back in the day, Srikanth excitedly coming and telling me, your problems are over. Your computer will work damn fast because we have this new chip or whatever I'm going to put into it. It's got 546 Mbps or something. And MB RAM. I didn't know what RAM was, but 546, it seemed like a big thing. And now you're talking of, 15 GB RAM.
Stuff. Yeah, now 546 will probably happen in a microsecond or something like that.
Yeah, so it was a complete leap of faith, like you said, knowing nothing about this and realizing. And one of the things that struck me later, which Ajit actually pointed out at the time, he said, if we do this, we'll be the first in the world to do it because there was no standalone news site for the internet. It was all shovelware, as we used to call it. Publishing houses, which were in print, pushing their print stuff onto the internet, right? Nobody was actually creating content for the internet per se, using things like hyperlinks and all the possibilities of the internet. So, yeah, it was completely unknown. Every day you screwed up and then you learned and did something better. Everything evolved. Commentary got stabilized when the lines started getting better. Then we started saying, actually, I remember there was a group of US students who visited us. This was in 98 or 98, I think it was. And they came to read of wanting to look around and stuff. And they spent some time with Ajit. And at some point I was called into the room. And so I was asking them about how they handle, how in the hell do you sit for an entire day and watch the stream of words, right?
Yeah.
And they were telling me stories like, oh, we take it in shifts. So we all sleep in one of the guys' rooms and two of us will be reading and the others will sleep and then we wake them up and they watch and all of that. And it struck me as odd that you could just sit there and wait for the next batch of words to pop up on your screen with nothing else to do, right? So again, we were talking to the techs and saying, can we give these guys something to do? Maybe a chat box or something where people could sort of interact with each other. They could even interact with me and stuff. And so we had the commentary on the left half and a chat box on the right. And so, yeah, it was basically just learn on the fly. And that, I think, was the exciting part of Edith.
You know, as ridiculous as it sounds about people reading chunks of text and then waking the other one up and getting them to read it, it also is a reflection of how people in America were so desperate and hungry for cricket. And so Cricinfo and Rediff and all these other things, when they came along, it was a godsend for them.
Yeah, I've heard that from a lot of, particularly you guys who... various of you used to be in the US at that time. And I remember friends from Cricinfo and all that telling me about following this over there. And And it's interesting that cricket was the pretty much the leader in this thing before this kind of coverage spread to other sport. I suppose the general, the worldwide audience for cricket is also partly responsible. It's one of those surefire things, right? Cricket actually gave Rediff initially a huge boost because a lot of people came for the cricket coverage and then realized that there was so much more. But everything kind of came together without conscious volition. The love for the sport, the fact that technology permitted these things, the fact that there was a ready-made audience for it. Anything cricket, anytime, right? I mean, people just... I think a whole lot of people follow me on Twitter still because of what I did in 2000 or something. Not because of my politics or any of the other things.
Absolutely. So coming to, we've spoken about the people in Rediff themselves. I mean, how the journalists saw it and how the audience saw it. But how did the players and the board and everyone else who were in the cricket sphere, how did they see this whole thing? Did they even pay you guys any attention? Or were you seen more like some oddity doing something in some corner of Mumbai?
No, actually, and I have to thank the diaspora for that. I mean, we have to thank the diaspora for this. I think, funnily enough, the cricketers caught on to this before the mainstream journalists did, in a manner of speaking. An example would be, say, for instance, the 96 tour of England. Dravid, Saurav and all of that, that particular series. These guys used to, you know how the Indian team is on tour, right? They keep getting invited to the homes of Indians for meals and stuff.
Yeah.
And they heard about Rediff from these people who were hosting them. Oh, have you read what Rediff said about this innings? Or have you read what Rediff said about this other thing and all that? So it was surprisingly, for us at least, it was surprising that actually cricketers reached out to us, as opposed to the other way around. Immediately after the 96, by then we had started this thing on Rediff, live chats with celebrities. TN Station kicked it off. LK Adwani was the second. And the third was Saurav Ganguly.
And, oh, wow.
It was the easiest thing in the world. All we had to do was call Saurav and say, we're calling from this thing called Rediff. And he's, oh, yeah, I know Rediff. What do you need? And we said, how about an internet chat? Will you come on live? And he just said, yes, absolutely no questions asked. I think what happened probably was that because the diaspora was consuming cricket via Rediff, at least in 96, it was top of the mind for them. So they would keep bringing it up and these players kept hearing about it. More than they were hearing about, say, conventional media, which, you know, these guys had to wait to consume. I suppose it gave us a kind of instant entry and also a kind of, I wouldn't use the word cachet so much as there was goodwill. The players had considerable goodwill towards us. Nobody refused to talk to us. They reached out to us when they wanted to talk about something. I think there was one of the most famous examples was when the players were fighting for a contract system. They were the ones who told us about it. They were the ones who told us about the problems. People like Kumble, for instance, Dravid, Srinath. This is where we heard about it for the first time. And it was a very sort of proactive back and forth where the players, I remember, we had good relations with the Australian team. In fact, with the touring teams, because again, we were an internet company. They needed help setting things up in the hotels and stuff, and they would call us. So the relationships were very good.
And what about the great embracer of new technology, the BCCI?
The BCCI was a whole other story. You know, the funniest story I remember about the BCCI and technology was when, I remember that tour of Australia, Kapil Dev was the coach.
And
Tendulkar was the captain. And that was made famous, by the way, because Lele opened his mouth in an interview.
3-0.
Yeah, 3-0. And
this was to Rediff, right?
Yeah, this was for Rediff. And yeah. So we had written that story. We said, look, I mean, the BCCI is supposed to be sending the best possible team. What signal is it when the secretary of the BCCI is saying these guys are going to be blanked? And Lele promptly denied it because Dalmia told him to deny it. And then they said they'll file a case. And we said, yeah, fine. We'll see you in court. We'd love to play the recording for you. And nothing further was heard about it, by the way. But I suppose the case still exists in some court somewhere, God knows. But the funniest part was, at that time, the players were also lobbying for, they wanted a video recording equipment and a computer, a laptop to sort of review their own thing. And so I called up Lele and asked him, you know, the players are asking for this. And Lele, in exasperation, said, if I remember correctly, something like, "Are yaar, in logon ko kya kya chahiye? We've given them a bat, we've given them a ball. Abhi, now they want a video camera. What are they going to do? Make short movies? What's going on? Why do they need all this?" And it's so bizarre. They just refused to open their minds to anything at all. The players really had to fight. In fact, Kapildev, at his personal expense, bought a video camera to take with him on that tour. And he was the one who was recording practice sessions and then showing it to the players and stuff. It was much later that it, you know, once Wright and all that came in, pretty much finally figured out that these things were actually important. And it was bizarre. You couldn't have a conversation with the BCCI about anything at all. If you ask them about the contract system, I remember... again, it was Lele who made this statement. He said, you know, we have a big, big talent pool. So, kisi ko injured ho gaya, toh hum kya kare? That's just part of how it is, and it's not our business. There are always other players to replace it. I think, yeah, they didn't see cricket as something really worth investing in. It was just something to make money off of.
A couple of years later, in that famous 2001 series, you know, which is now turning 20 years, there is, I was reading one column of yours where you basically mentioned how, you know, a correspondent of yours in Calcutta was denied entry by Dalmia because apparently you guys had written a strong piece criticizing him about something. And he said, no .com journalists allowed. And he just put a blanket ban up there.
Yeah, actually, I mean, there it was directly denied by Dalmia himself. But late 96 onwards, what had happened was that in between series, you had to have some kind of coverage, right? And at that time, we were in no mood to just do the anodyne stuff. Coincidentally, a copy of the BCCI's annual report fell into my hands. Here's a funny tidbit from that. In the year in question, the Delhi District Cricket Association spent 18 lakh on one item of clothing. Can you guess what that item of clothing would have been?
No.
Okay, neckties. Yeah, these guys, that entire thing was, I mean, it belonged on the fiction shelves. So we did a series on how the so-called honorary office bearers of the BCCI and its member associations were really milking the sport, right? And we were promptly banned from all stadiums. An unofficial ban, but a very real ban. Lele actually told us about it, saying, don't even bother applying because tum logon ko nahi ticket milne wala. which also led to this funny thing when Steve Waugh came visiting. War and some of the others wanted to do all sorts of things like, you know, going and seeing Dobi Talao, and they wanted to walk through Kamathipura, the red light area in Bombay,
yeah.
All of that, right? And they dragged us into this. So imagine escorting Glenn McGrath and Steve Waugh and all that through the red light district. It was insane. These women were shouting all sorts of things. And Steve Waugh would go, what did she say just now? And you're like, Steve, you don't want to know. So that happened. And that practice game against Bombay happened. And somewhere on the sidelines, we met with a couple of the players. And Stephen Bernard was there. And somebody casually asked, one of them casually asked, so we'll see you at the test. And I said, no, you won't, because we won't be given passes. So Steve was like, what are you talking about? And they have these players' passes, right?
Yeah.
And he promptly went to his room and picked up some 3-4 passes and handed it over and said, we'll see you guys there. So I couldn't go to the ground, because if you remember those days, you didn't have a dedicated line, right, for each person.
Oh, yeah.
So you couldn't hog the one internet line that existed to do ball by ball. So
you had to go to the press center and you had to file.
Yeah, and you had to wait in line and all of that stuff. So ball by ball was out of the question from the grounds. So I would do it from the Rediff office. Ashish Magotra just joined. And so we gave him a pass and said, listen, you go there. And if you see something interesting, just call it in. We can fold it into our coverage. And journalists, by the way, senior journalists of that time, told Ashish that he couldn't sit in the press box. Ashish had a VIP pass from courtesy the Australians. So he came back looking fairly dejected, and we lost our cool. And Faisal then took Ashish back, and we kind of made an issue out of it. Lele came and asked, who gave you passes? And he said, well, the Australians did, so what are you going to do about it?
Wow.
Nothing that they could do. So, yeah. it was Bapka Raja, na? So they could do anything. The funny part was Lele, after all that, he was still very fond of Rediff. He would not only call us proactively to tell us things and then pretend that he had never told it to us and we must have got it from somebody else. He would actually call and say, kya, for some days you haven't called, what? You don't call me these days and all of that. I remember going for a selection meeting which was being held in Baroda, in his hometown. And the selection meeting was supposed to start at about 11. I reached there slightly early and I found Lele there. So Lele said, ah, chal, baat karte hain. And he took me into the room where the selection meeting was to be held. And he was holding forth about all sorts of things. So Shivlal Yadav was the chairman of selectors at that time. He pokes his head in and says, Lele saab, meeting. And Lele just waved him away and said, can't you see? I'm talking to somebody. I'll call you when I'm ready. And that was it. The selectors just walked off. It was feudalism at its best or worst, which is the way you want to look at it.
Yeah, I never got this whole thing with, I mean, I did get it, but it was all so contradictory, because every single person in an association in BCCI used to go to Crickinfo and Rediff every day. Because they would go and check what was there on it. And they were really desperate that all their players and everyone else gets the maximum coverage. But at the same time, when it came to accreditation, they would always pick up a fuss.
Absolutely. The funniest part was, after 2-3 of these stories that we did based on the on the annual reports and stuff, Dalmia instituted an internal rule that there would be only 2 copies of this thing. One would be with him and one would be with the secretary. So when I learned that, I went to the BCCI office and asked for the latest thing, and they said, nahi, hamare paas bhi nahi hai. So I called up Lele, and Lele said, I saw there are only 2 copies, and he said, we'll see. And then one official from the BCCI calls me one day and says, can you come this evening to, there is a seedy little bar just in the lane behind the Taj.
Yeah.
Mostly frequented by gays, particularly during the weekends. And he called me to that bar. And I go there and there's this brown envelope. It felt like something out of a spy movie or something. He passed it to me under the table, and I open it and I see the whole thing. Obviously Lele must have done it. Xerox the whole thing and sent it across. So there was, like you said, this thing of, they were very aware of what Crickinfo was writing and what Rediff was writing and stuff. And when they wanted to get their point of view across, they would quietly call you for a meeting or whatever and tell you things and say, hey, sub off record, yeah, tum likho, lekin, don't say where you got it from. But yeah, we got, I'm sure it was the case with Crickinfo as well. We got a lot of our stories from the very people who were part of this whole thing. Do you remember Sunil Dev?
Of course, yeah. So Delhi.
So Sunil Dev once called me when I was in Delhi. He said, come over for a meeting and stuff like that. And we sat in his office and we were chatting. And he suddenly tossed in this phrase, one day before, one day after. So I was like, what the hell is that? So he said, tere ko pata nahi hai. So what used to happen apparently was that selectors had been mandated to go with the teams. And these guys are honorary, right? So they're only supposed to get expenses.
Yeah.
So how it works is that if you're working for Cricinfo, I mean, if you're working for cricket, for the BCCI, you get to claim a certain amount for the day you're working, the day before that, and the day after that. Because the day before that, you're preparing for your work, and the day after that, you are following up and stuff. So how these guys used to file their expense sheets was, if it was a test match, the day before the test, the first day of the test, and the day after the test would be one expense. So they filed one day before, day of the test match, day after the test match. Then for the second day, they would file one day before, one day after, and the day of the game. So five matches, imagine every single day would be, I mean, 5 day matches, every single day would be one day before, one day after. I swear I'm not making this up. Lele once submitted an expense sheet, and then some CA kindly pointed out to him that he had expensed about 430 days out of 365. So it's almost beyond belief what was going on in that organization at that time.
Yeah, so and this was also around, I mean, we're talking 2001 99, this was also around the time when the biggest story broke, which was fixing. Yeah, and you were basically, I remember you used to almost write a daily report, if not twice a day, updating people about what was happening.
Yeah, actually the funny thing is, Krishna Prasad was with us. I mean, he was a colleague at the Sunday Observer. And he had, at some point, spoken to one of these bookies. And from him, he had heard stories of fixing dating back into the 80s and all that.
Yeah.
He had done a small piece in the Sunday Observer, very broadly skimming the surface. The piece was more about how bookies operate as opposed to who was involved with the Indian team and all that. And then once he joined Outlook, he and Anirudh Bahel did that expose.
Big expose, and, yeah.
Yeah, and after that, it became... But a lot of us, I'm sure the same case, you were working in Cricinfo at the time, if I remember correctly. All of you guys were stellar.
No, I had actually, I joined a little later, so I missed the whole fixing thing. Yeah.
All right. But yeah, Cricinfo was also following that. And there were those hearings in South Africa, right, which we were covering live.
King Commission, yeah.
Yeah, the King Commission. So we had somebody in South Africa fax us the actual statements, the transcripts, day by day, and we would use that for our coverage and stuff. And yeah, it was one of those times. I think it was also, in a sense, a precursor to what happens today, where things are so polarized that whatever you write, you get into trouble one way or the other. So because Azhar's name came up in some of the reports that we did, and we had a lot of people calling with threats and stuff back in the
day.
Wow. Yeah, like how dare you write about him and all of that shit. So yeah, that was one of the... I think that was also the moment when... I mean, I quit full-time cricket writing in 2001, late 2001. At some point, I just had enough. One of the proximate causes was this, because see, we report on cricket in good faith, right? We see what is happening and we say, if the batsman plays a bad stroke, way of processing it is, yeah, he made a mistake. But then you realize that these mistakes are sometimes deliberate. There are things that you just can't understand. I remember a game where, one day game where Hansi Kronier was the captain, and the field set was so bizarre. They're just giving runs away for free. And the match report, I wrote about how you just couldn't understand how could you give this particular bowler the new ball when he was bowling straight, flat, outside the off stump, and he was getting creamed through the offside repeatedly. And why he wasn't chained, he had an extended spell. Now, you think that these are captains making bad decisions in the heat of the moment? And then when you realize that 90% of what you've written is just BS, there's something else going on behind the scenes, how the hell do you continue writing with that kind of involvement and passion, right? So there was that, and there was also this funny moment. Somebody forwarded me a parody site where, among other things, I mean, that guy was parodying everything and anything, but one of the parodies was a parody of a Prem Panicker math report. And I read it, and he was bang on accurate. I mean, it was funny, but it was also accurate because, I mean, remember the kind of amount of cricket that used to be played at that time. So you're coming in every single day and doing the same thing over and over again. And we seem to be playing Sri Lanka 10 times a year. Either you were going there or they were coming here, and the same people doing the same things to the same people. I realized that I was phoning it in. I was working off of some kind of internal template and just filling in the blanks and stuff. So I started worrying about what it was doing to my writing and to my love for the game. And so at that point, yeah, I told my editor that I wanted out. Yeah.
Completely get the sentiment. I was pretty much in that phase in 2008 when, you know, I think, you know, it seems like you had 5 years and I had a similar 5-year stretch. So we probably reached the end of the tether around the same time in the thing. But I wanted to touch upon one thing. I mean, it's amazing how there's so much of repetition when it comes to technology. I mean, we did speak about how what you were doing back in the late 90s was pretty much what blogging ended up being later and what Twitter ended up being later. The other thing you did, of course, is what we're now doing as podcasts. But back then, you were doing it as internet radio. Can you talk a bit about that? Panic Station was quite a big hit back then.
Yeah. 2001 World Cup or something, right? It was, again, one of those, you know, spur-of-the-moment things. At some point, Ajit Balakrishnan wanted to explore the potential of radio. So they built a very, very tiny studio. I swear it was claustrophobic almost, in the space that was available in the Rediff office in Mahim. And then sprung it on me that I was supposed to do audio commentary. So what I had to do was sit and look at the screen with the volume off and just call the play. And it was bizarre because just like with the written thing, where I went into it without much of an idea of what it involved. I mean, if you think about writing 20, 30 words per ball across a game, that's a novel. And you come back and do it again the next day. And then you do your maths report and then you do columns and stuff, right? The same thing with audio commentary. You realize that you were stuck. You couldn't even go take a leak when you wanted to. And I think one of the funny things was there was this Associate Nation that played. I forget which one it was, but what I do remember is I hadn't seen any of them play. I didn't know their names. I didn't know. I mean, you had the scoreboard, so you knew the names. But these guys are under the helmets. I had no way of recognizing them. So the commentary for that particular game was something on the lines of, you know, Anil Kumble bowls and the batsman plays it to cover because I didn't know who the batsman was. And I got slammed for that. But it was fun in the sense that what we did, which worked, was we had this thing where readers could submit questions. And as soon as lunch was called, I was given a 5-minute break to use the washroom and stuff. And then we did this question and answer thing. So there was Mahesh. And there was Krishna Prasad and me. And I think we used the soundtrack of one of those Tamil... there's a movie called Dhool, I think.
Okay, Dhool.
At that time, there was this catchy little Kuttu number in that. And we used the opening soundtrack of that. And it was fun. It was just all kinds of questions would come in and we would respond. And it was humorous. It was lighthearted. We created several of these standing jokes. Mahesh was always late. He would come in 5 minutes later. So people started writing in and saying, I have a question, but please wait till Mahesh comes back because I want to hear Mahesh reading the question and things. It was huge fun, except it was incredibly tiring just sitting there. And after that, having to write a maths report, I realized that this was not something that we wanted to do for keeps. Mercifully, what happened was that it didn't fly with the advertisers at that time. So So that experiment ended after one World Cup.
Yeah, I think it might probably was the mini World Cup, right?
The small. Yeah.
What became the Champions Trophy after that. Yeah. So you left full-time cricket writing, but then, you know, blogging basically came in, and then you took pretty much naturally to blogging almost, you know, without too much of a break. I think by 2002 or 2003, you were already blogging on quite a regular basis, and, you know, cricket was still very much part of your daily, you know, life.
Yeah, it was, because by then I was in the US and Willow TV had just started out. So they needed, so the guys who founded Willow TV reached out to me and said, listen, for this first series, we'll give you a complimentary sort of entry. Could you use the service and tell us what you think and all that? And there was much to love about Willow, because if you remember, their video was connected to their scoreboard. So you could click on a batsman and see his play, or you could click on wickets and just see the wickets again. And I think blogging, in a sense, the catalyst was that when you're watching a match, you've done the same thing, so you know about this. We take extensive notes, right? It's not just sit back after the match and try and recall things. You're taking notes in the moment. And when you write the match report, then it's a question of what are you leaving out? And there were so many of these little things that used to catch your attention at the time, in the moment, which you never used. So the blog became a way of maybe using some of these things to make little points or to capture a little moment and stuff like that. And it was, it didn't feel as pressurizing as having to do ball by ball for an entire match. I think the difference between, say, what I had to do for Rediff and what you guys did in Crick Info was you had people doing it in shifts. So either a session or an hour or whatever. I had to do it entirely start to finish. So you literally were captive in front of the screen. One of the things I learned at that time was never to drink coffee, because then you would want to use the washroom. So coffee was out, drinking water was out, all of that. And blogging became, I think, a way of staying in touch with the game, more or less, but only doing what you wanted to do as opposed to what you were expected to do. You didn't have to do match reports. And I think the moment that it became a tipping point was when I started doing these threads, which kind of foreshadowed what happens on Twitter these days, where I would just say day one, session one, and open up the comments. And I'd keep posting on that. And at the same time, there would be people commenting, and I would bring the comment back into the blog and respond to it and stuff. It was huge fun. I think what helped was that India Abroad had a much more relaxed sort of production schedule. We used to get very busy on Fridays and Saturdays when the edition went to bed, but the rest of the time it didn't matter. And if the game was happening at some other time zone, it was fine. You watched. The fact that I had access to Willow TV meant that Tunku Vardarajan would sometimes come home and sit and watch with me. And I think Shashi Tharoor came a couple of times home. He loved curd rice, so my wife had to make curd rice for him. and he would sit and watch the match and stuff. So it was a change of pace, and I think it was a way of, you know, doing say the kind of thing that you were doing again, to go back to that, to take little moments and write about them as opposed to writing about entire matches and stuff.
Yeah, and I think the one of the biggest you know, things about blogging is that if there was a game that you saw and that you know, left you cold and gave you no inspiration, you didn't have to write about it. And exactly. You know that, but that is not an option you have as a full-time writer. You have to still pull out that thousand whatever number of words to write something about it, even on a dead day.
Yeah, and you had to you had to make something of it, right? I mean, there was the expectation of your of the institution you were working with. They wouldn't let you just phone it in. And I mean, imagine doing a match report on that bloody Sri Lanka series where Mahanama and
Jayasurya.
Jayasurya batted. I did ball by ball on that one, man. And every bloody ball was bowled outside the off stump, driven through covers, four runs, bowled outside the off stump, cut through point, four runs. I mean, for 2 days. And then you do a match report. I talked about proximate causes for leaving cricket writing. I think this was also equally important, that particular series and that particular match.
Though that just match happened in 1997, Prem, you hung on for 4 more years.
But it was there, right? I mean, it's like one of those things that haunt you for a lifetime. You went home and you woke up next morning and you're like, oh shit, I have to go and watch these two guys bat again.
In my head, Jayasurya is still batting.
Yeah. It's one of those nightmares you don't easily recover from.
Yeah, so which brings me from blogging to Twitter, and it almost then around the mid-2000s and late-2000s, it almost became like, this two screens. You had one screen where you watched the game, and then you had another screen where you interacted with the game. I mean, just like it would have been for the US guys in the late 90s with Rediff, but now this was a much larger population of people getting used to that second screen through and through.
Yeah. I remember when Twitter was launched and somebody from the US sent me, I think it was, there was some kind of invitation business. I'm not very sure about it, but somebody from the US sent me the link and said, can you try this out and see what happens? And I'd just come back to India at the time. And I logged in and I didn't see the point initially. What was I going to do with this thing? And I think what showed me the possibilities was when 2611 happened. Part of the time I was at the desk collating reports and rewriting them into a cohesive narrative. And part of the time I was covering it live, first at the Oberoi and then at the Taj. And I initially, I remember what happened was you couldn't just keep calling, right, for every little thing. So we needed a means of sending information very quickly back to the desk. So I suddenly remembered Twitter and I told the guys at the desk, listen, just log in and follow me on Twitter and I'll just keep typing as I see things. So you have that and then you can cut, paste and do whatever you want with it. And so I was doing it primarily as a means of communicating with the office, but suddenly the following exploded from about a couple of dozen to, I think, over 2,000 in the course of 2 days. And that kind of woke me up to the possibilities, I think, of instantaneous communication, of unfettered communication, if you will, because it was not on your home platform. So you could pretty much say what you wanted. It was your private space. That combination and the fact that you had immediate responses, that I think was a kind of tipping point. And then like so many others, and also the collegiality of it, right? You got to watch a match and at the same time, you got to interact with a whole lot of people who were also watching the match and who had opinions. And so there were all you cricket writers were there, but also a lot of cricket fans with a lot of interesting things to say, which sometimes didn't even occur to you. So, yeah, that became a huge thing. I still use it occasionally for mostly test matches.
Over the last 10 years, or definitely over the last 5 years, what I've noticed is that the amount of cricket writers, many of them largely amateur, who are coming up with spectacular insight, in terms of numbers and data and analysis. I mean, it's just changing cricket writing. And I think in the next 5 years, you could see a sea change in the way cricket is reported and written about, right?
Totally. And data is an important component because now increasingly you have tremendous access to data, right? And the amount of data has also exploded. I think Kartikeya does a lot of that work. Rajesh,
yeah, Kartikeya does a lot of that. Kartik Krishnaswamy from
exactly
Chicken Po and Siddharth Monga, all those guys. I mean, the way in which they even watch the game and describe it is undergoing a sea change.
Yeah, and it's a good thing, I think, because this symbiotic relationship between the player and the media was, to my mind, one of the things that was spoiling cricket coverage. Break that umbilical cord, and I think, like you said, I mean, you mentioned 5 years. I hope it doesn't take 5 years, because this has happened. It's not even an evolving thing. Players going directly to their fan base is very much a thing now. And I think even before Ashwin, remember Chahal used to do those funny...
Chahal TV, yeah.
Yeah, and he used to get a lot of following for that. So players will figure it out pretty much. And the way Ashwin has succeeded with this will interest more and more players. And this will become a thing.
Yeah, I wonder if we'll soon see. I mean, I don't know. I doubt it. But, you know, it'd be nice if the players can have some version of a player's tribune, you know, maybe not necessarily in print, but even if it can be online, if it can be players telling us their own stories in honest, truthful ways without the journalists having. I mean, of course, there can be an editor who can put things together in an editorial sense, but there doesn't need to be any input from anyone. That'll be something that'll be interesting to see from all the players.
Yeah. And it could happen organically, right? Because one of the things is the players guaranteed an audience, one. And brands are going to want to buy into that whole thing. So imagine, for instance, the value of, let's say, Virat Kohli doing a video series called Captain's Corner or whatever, where he talks about the game as he saw it and the various moments and stuff. If he starts doing that, it's going to be an easy sell for his managers. There'll be brands lining up. I wouldn't be very surprised if Ashwin gets sponsored for his videos fairly soon. I hope it happens, actually, because, like you said, the press conference is a complete waste. It's like, we have to execute the Yorker. I've never understood how you execute a Yorker. we have to, we just have to stick with our processes and we have to execute our plans and we have to rely on our skill sets. It's that coach speak has become, you tune off, really. So maybe doing it on their own will give them that freedom as well. And there will be a commercial element coming in. And once that comes in, it'll explode. So could be good times.
Absolutely. And specifically, I know that, you always say that you quit full-time cricket writing long back and have no intention of going in there. But what do you see, especially in the technology space, that gives you the most hope in terms of cricket and writing and coverage and, etc.?
The fact that there are so many different ways you can do it. Look, we keep using the word writing, but today you can cover a cricket match or you can be part of a cricket match or you can be a cricket journalist in so many different ways, right? You could do live blogs, you can do podcasts like you're doing, you can do...
Clubhouse.
Clubhouse, yes, exactly. I was coming to that. You can do Twitter threads, and start conversations. You can do Clubhouse where you it takes you back to those days when you actually enjoyed cricket in two ways. One is the game itself and one is the company. There was a recent episode of Clubhouse. I think it was way past your bedtime, Sid, where Jared Kimber was on and I was on and Chandresh was on, and the discussion was fabulous. Because there were so many different perspectives. There were a couple of folks from England who joined in and who had a very different perspective from, say, that of an Indian fan about what was happening in Ahmedabad. that's all of these are going to be new things. And that is given. I remember back in the day when Ajit was trying to convince us about why we should be on the internet. He said, think of it this way. Think of the fact that when you're working in a newspaper, your view is restricted or you're looking through a window. And he said the size of the window depended on the kind of media it was. The way he explained it was, he said, suppose you're working for a national paper, the Nation is your beat, and that's all. Now, if you're working for a city paper, like we were working for Midday, for instance, what happens in the rest of the country is secondary to what is news for that particular audience, which is Mumbai City, primarily. He said the internet, on the other hand, is, suppose I were to take you blindfolded to the middle of the desert and remove the blindfold and leave you there. It's wide and vast and open on all sides, and the only limitation on you is your own imagination, right? If you can think it, you can do it. He said that's what the internet will do for you, and that's why you should be on it. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's coming true now. I mean, as a cricket journalist, it's entirely my call how I want to interact with the game. I might not want to write at all. I might just want to hang in clubhouse while the match is on, or I might just want to do a Twitter thread or a combination of both. Or at the end of it, if I think that there is something that I want to say at greater length, I could again do a podcast, or I could write, or I could do a video, talk to camera kind of thing on video. The sky is the limit.
But I also want to bring in, the flip side. We have seen the perils of technology and social media in aspects outside cricket, especially in the political arena. Do you also have a sense of worry that ultimately the obsession to control the message, and also with the extreme levels of partisanship and also politics, politics, of course, has always played a part in cricket, but now politics increasingly also getting in. Do you also worry in a sense of how cricket and tech could, the relationship could work out?
Not worry too much, because this is not even the new era, right? I mean, the reason why we stopped that chat interface along with the commentary was because people started spamming it, and people started being abusive on it. And it was a nightmare for a bit, because somebody would come in and abuse. All you needed was an email account, right? So you got an email account and you signed in, and you could say whatever you wanted. And if you banned that email account, they came right back with another email account. And so this kind of thing of people, for want of a
better trolling.
Trolling, misbehaving, all of that has been going on from, say, the late 90s onwards, in my experience at least. I don't worry too much about it, because what I do worry about is that it will create and reinforce bubbles. People who don't disagree with you are not following you or stop following you. So that avenue of persuasion, or even discussion for that matter, a kind of meeting of the minds where maybe at the end of it you agree to disagree, but at least there is that dialogue. And I think what is happening and what will increasingly happen is that there will be separate sort of spaces for people who think one way and spaces for people who think another way. And these two spaces will not really talk to one another. At best, they will troll each other, but not really have a conversation. And that, you see, like you pointed out, you see it in the political sphere, definitely. And to an extent, I think you're also seeing it in the cricket sphere, for instance. I mean, you might honestly want to do a piece in whatever medium, podcast or writing or video or whatever, which talks about, say, Kohli's latest innings as not being... It was valuable from a team point of view, but it was not vintage Kohli. He had to struggle. He had to be human. And you say that from a clear-eyed reading of what you saw when he was playing. But to say something like that then becomes, how dare you talk about Kohli like this?
Yeah.
And yeah, and either you get a lot of abuse, or the person sort of stops listening to you or following you or whatever. They don't look to engage with you and see if, why do you feel that way? Why, they don't ask the question, that basic question, why do you think that? Could it also be this? There is no dialogue. And increasingly, I think that will happen. Will that impact the way we interact with cricket? No, we'll continue to impact. We'll continue to interact with the game in the way that we know how, which is based as much on us as it is on what is happening in the game itself, right? Our sense of values, our sense of aesthetic, our sense of the sport and what it means. All of that will continue to dictate. It's just that we'll probably end up speaking to a like-minded audience and not necessarily to a wider audience that also includes people who disagree.
Great, Prem. I think I've taken a lot of your time, but this was wonderful. Thank you so much for all your lovely anecdotes and memories.
Not at all, yeah. It's a complete pleasure. It's been a long time since we chatted. So basically, our interactions have been, again, new media, Twitter, and all of that. But yeah, this is huge fun. One of these days, I'm going to reverse this. And on this podcast, I'm going to be the one asking you questions because you had that... you were again involved with cricket at a fairly seminal moment, right? The aftermath of match fixing, and then the Ganguly years, for instance.
Yeah, I think the seminal moment for me was the Chapel Ganguly years. So
we'll do that one of these days.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and Prem and I are also on Clubhouse, so you can follow us, and we'll end up doing quite a few chats there, maybe during games. So yeah, happy to chat anytime, and great fun, Prem. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Take care.
That brings us to the end of another episode of the 81 All Out podcast. If you enjoy the work we do, please support us via ko-fi.com. That's ko-fi.com/81allout. You can find the link in the show notes, and it'll allow you to either set up a recurring monthly payment or throw in a one-time contribution. Also, please subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever else you prefer. It would be great if you could leave a rating and a review so that more people can find us. As always, we would love to hear your thoughts on the work we do, so please send us your feedback.
India home, Lords goes wide.